Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this AlignMark Technical Net. My Mark Technical Net has been going strong for 43 years plus. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we gather together in front of our radios to exchange information, ideas, form to educate, to be informed, to be educated, and to be entertained, and to be entertaining, hopefully. So I hope a lot of people have joined me once again tonight for another episode of the AlignMark Technical Net, and I'll let it drop for a second, and then I will return to offer you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me and you can't do it by the radio, then email is a good idea. That would be for a number of different reasons. If you have what we used to call mailbag questions, those are questions that you would like to ask during the technical net, but you don't have access to a radio and you can't tell us what the question is, so you email it to me, and if appropriate, we discuss it. Also, for a topic, sometimes important things happen that have a technical bent that some of our listeners and participators are familiar with, and they like to share their knowledge, so they'll tell me occasionally that this particular field is, they know it, and they would like to discuss it, and we open the technical net for their discussion of that topic. Sometimes people just want to be part of a discussion of a topic, and other times some people just want to hear other people discuss a topic because they feel unfamiliar with it. So that's the reason. Also, technical puzzles. We're always looking for technical puzzles to stimulate conversation and thought. The best ones are the ones that you can't Google in a couple of seconds because those are a little too easy for some people. I prefer the technical puzzles where if you Google it, you get the wrong answer, and I've been able to do that more than a few times, so that's loads of fun. Also, if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder about a NASA or space-related story, get his take on it. You could, of course, email him directly at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Or you can email me. My email address for the technical net is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. I collect a bunch of interesting links over the previous week, things that I think other people might find interesting. There are some interesting YouTube that kind of cast a somewhat jaundiced eye at good old Elon's SpaceX results lately. But there are other things as well, and there are interesting articles. And you can peruse it at your leisure. You get there by just typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. Those links are available 24/7. They'll be up, hopefully, for the next few years. So anytime you feel so inclined, check them out. They're interesting reading material. We have a chat room. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's quiet, but you can check it out yourself. Just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. That'll bring you to the chat room. We have an audio stream of the technical net. If you don't have a radio or you know someone who doesn't have a radio that can listen to our repeater, if they type into their browser technet.ac2gs.com, it'll come up with an audio stream. We started that originally solely for the technical net, but some people asked me to keep it live for the rest of the week, so it's live 24/7, except for the occasional reboot of my computer. Also, want to remind people, MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site called AmateurRadio.tv. It has archives of the AlignMark Technical Net going as far back as 2006. So avail yourself of those recordings of the wisdom of hams who've either moved away from the area or passed away and become silent thieves. Let me drop for a second, and I'll come right back. Well, tonight we'll ask for questions of a technical nature first, preferably amateur radio technology. But as the night progresses, we'll open things up to any field of science and technology that's of interest, and I will try my best to either provide an answer or suggest reference material to look elsewhere. We'll see what happens. That should go until about 10:15 when Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report. which will take us to 11 p.m., in which I'll return and tie a bow on it and wish you all well and call it a week. So that's the plan if the universe continues doing what it's been doing lately and doesn't misbehave. So I will ask people out there, if you have any questions or comments for the technical net tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
KD2OGB Mobile. No questions right now, just saying hello.
Okay, Craig recognized. Hello back. Anyone else with any questions or topics for tonight? Golly gosh.
Yes, everything is quiet today.
Well,
I'm surprised.
I don't know what to tell you guys. I'll tell you a story about my computer. I know this isn't the computer net, and my apologies to Ken, but I got a few minutes to kill, so let me tell people a cautionary tale. I purchased a new network-attached storage device called NASA. I have one already. It's in my basement, but I've kind of gotten a little bit paranoid about backing up my backups of my backups, so I figure I'll have one for this floor, and it will mirror the one in the basement. It's, as long as the whole house doesn't blow up, I'll be safe with my storage material. Anyway, I was playing around with the file shared from my old NAS, and I needed to disconnect it from one of my PCs and then reestablish it. And I could not reestablish it. It kept on telling me that it could not make the connection and I should talk to the administrator. And since this is my house and I'm the administrator, that would just be talking to myself. So I had to Google it and re-Google it and re-re-Google it. And finally, let me drop for a second and I'll tell you what I discovered. Okay. Unbeknownst to me, at least, back in Windows 7, Microsoft started to include something that they called the Credential Manager. I had never heard of it before, but it was hidden away someplace deep in the vestiges of Windows 7 and 8 and 10 and 11. So I summoned a Credential Manager and found an entry for that NAS and deleted it and then reconnected it without a problem. So for anyone out there, if you ever have any problem where you're sharing files over a network and it's no longer giving you access to it and tells you to talk to yourself, seek out the credential manager and delete the entry and then reestablish a connection. So put it away in the back of your mind as something to try if the problem ever occurs. Anyway, I thought I would share that with everyone. So, once again, I am AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net, and if anyone has any topics for discussion or questions, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk, and give me your first name and your call sign. We'll do this thing that we do.
KD2OGB Mobile, I actually have a question about your little story with backing up backups of backups. I find that kind of interesting.
Okay, Craig. I mean, the bottom line is you can never have too many backups. I am not doing the proper job that a professional would because one of the things that I have not really done is to store things off-site. One of the things that most professionals will do is either have a cloud-based storage facility, which can get rather expensive if it's a personal account, Or an easier thing is to just, if I took my NAS and gave it to a friend at another location and then linked it over the internet, I could then use that as an external storage. And if, God forbid, my house burnt down, I would have that storage available in his house. And if his house burnt down, likewise. So that's one of the things that I've never gotten around to doing. I'm just hoping that nothing burns down here.
I'll just explain it all, so now it'll be a comment. My suggestion, as much as how having backups of backups, you want to have a backup on a physical drive, a backup on another hard drive, and then preferably what you should do is go through them and then cherry pick all the stuff that you know you would need, because you're obviously not going to need all of it. So you would use a much smaller hard drive for that, but then you would use maybe a couple of terabytes to fully back up everything, plus a backup drive. And then using a smaller drive, maybe like a 1 terabyte, cherry pick all the stuff that you know you'll need, even though you don't need most of it. That's what I would do. And yes, I got storage on the cloud, even though not a lot of people like that because they're paranoid. They don't like their stuff being out in cyberspace. You also could put some drives in a safe. You could put it at a friend's house or an alternate location like at work or your office. And it definitely saves you a lot of grief. If there is a problem, crash, fire, water, theft, anything, it'll definitely save you in the long haul.
Yeah, AC2GS, I agree with you, Craig. I mentioned it earlier that either putting it up on the clouds, and for people who are significantly paranoid, there are applications that will encrypt the files before they get uploaded to an encrypted cloud. So, unless you happen to have a quantum computer ready that hasn't probably been developed yet, unless the NSA is telling us one way or the other, you're pretty safe. Either with cloud or with a parallel system at someone's house or at business or what have you. I prefer that over the putting it in a bank vault because you can't update it regularly. It's a very inconvenient. If you have specific information that you have to keep under all, then maybe a bank vault. But if you're backing up personal information, things that are subject to change, I think the problem would be people wouldn't be in the habit of regularly going to the bank to swap hard drives. So, unfortunately, I take the lazy man's approach instead of shuffling through it and figuring out what's the important stuff and what's the nonsense. Both importance and nonsense gets duplicated and reduplicated and reduplicated. Because hard drive space is relatively inexpensive. You have to understand that I come from an ancient time where a 2 megabyte hard drive would go for $2,000. And the salesman thought he was giving you a bargain. Keep in mind that my new NASs are full of 20 terabyte hard drives, 5 of them. So space is relatively cheap these days.
ADE2OGB Mobile, that's Highway Eastbound. The problem with 20 terabyte hard drives is you're looking at probably $1,000 or more. Probably the highest you'll ever get maybe is like a 6 terabyte. Maybe for a little over $100, it's not terrible. I mean, I have a couple of 2 and 3 terabyte book drives. I actually love the way those look. But you do need to be careful because they are DC powered, or you do need to externally power it through hardwire, so those things can be a little risky because if you disconnect them the wrong way or if thunder hits and you're not on a surge protected battery, enjoy those things getting fried and losing probably everything with a 98% probability of not getting it back.
Well, I heard someone out there, you doubled a little while, so I'm going to ask them to repeat their ID right after I'm done. Technology today is very weird. If you don't keep an eye on everything, it's subject to change. And so you develop these bits of fact that have been expired. Maybe 2-3 years ago, that was the price. The hard drives I bought, the 20 terabytes, were about $330 a piece. And they weren't particularly on sale. I got them off of Amazon. They were new. Having separate hard drives are nice, and if you need to transfer sneaker net type of information, but RAIDs are very useful. The purpose of most network-attached storage devices is that if a hard drive should have a critical malfunction and die, all your information is still on your NAS. What it does is it stores, in the case of RAID 5 configuration, it stores an extra drive which is parity of the other drive. And so you can reconstruct the broken drive onto a new drive in a matter of a couple of days, depending upon the storage capacity of each hard drive. So They're not bulletproof, but they're relatively close to it. People who are particularly paranoid go from a RAID 5 configuration where it's one spare drive with a parity to RAID 6, which is two spare drives with for parity. By the way, I just want to find out, you know, the person who tried to make the comment, please try again.
Yeah, this is Kilo 4 Bravo Bravo, you know, this is family. Sorry for the change of topic, but just as soon as you guys think of VHS fans, I might be trying to get it.
Okay, if you got a question, I'm more than happy to put it on the list, and when we're done with Craig, we'll get back to you. If you could give us a slightly stronger signal, I would appreciate it. You're kind of noisy in the background there.
Sure thing. This might be better. I don't know. But my question is, first off, I'm listening for DBL, for Bravo Bravo Lima, and I just wanted to get his opinion on VHS fans might be wanting to get into that stuff.
Okay, what's your first name, sir?
Name here is Brian, B-R-I-A-N, Brian.
Okay, very good, Brian. Let me finish up with Craig, and then we'll get back to you, and we'll discuss the different HF bands, the pluses and the minuses. So, Craig, like I said, I kind of agree on the general belief of you should certainly select your important stuff first, but I did want to make you aware that the price of hard drives, not all of them, but and these aren't kind of bottom of the barrel. These are Seagate that are designed for network-attached storage devices, and like I said, they're going at $330. They're not the newest version. I think these are SDEs or something, and there's an SDN that's probably $100 or $150 more. But the prices of high-capacity drives are plummeting. The most expensive hard drive I know of, the capacity is now 22 terabytes a piece. I guess they have an extra FLATA in them or something. That kicked it up from about $330 to about $500 and change, and that was a little too rich for my taste.
KD2OGB, I am going to have to spend about a minute offline to switch sources because I'm in my driveway, so you might have to give me maybe 30 to 40 seconds, because I would love to continue this conversation longer. Interestingly enough, Wi-Fi hard drives do exist where they have Bluetooth capabilities in them, and you can also just remotely send stuff over to them. I even looked at that idea, too, but I don't know if they're really reliable or not.
Yeah, I'll let you get into your house, and we'll do something with the next 40 seconds. How's that?
Ed Y2H.
Yes, Lou.
Lou, give me a minute and a half.
Okay, consider yourself having a minute and a half. What can I do for you tonight, Lou?
I was saying on the same topic, just adding a little bit to it. Were you ever subject to a ransomware attack where they encrypted your files?
Thankfully, no. My new NAS, I have Synology network attached storage devices. And they're a well, respected brand. When I bought my first NAS, I used, it was EXT4. Over the years, they've shifted over to something called BTFRS that has the ability to have memory like Apple's Time Machine does. So they suggest that if I'm at all cautious about it, I should enable that feature so that if ransomware should try to encrypt my files, there would be a previous version available to me.
Yeah, I remember the old PDP computers used to have that, I think, as kind of a default. So you'd have, like, version 2, version 3, version 4, whatever, which is good. But aside from all the other techniques, you know, local storage or your own devices, just talking about the cloud, what I was doing is I have the Google Drive, and that's synchronized so my files get over to that. But then I wondered if I did get a ransomware attack and then a sync occurred, you know, I might lose it up there. So what I've been doing was I also have a Dropbox account. So manually on my own, I will transfer files over to that and do that manually. And of course, the Dropbox account is not on synchronization mode. I have the synchronization off, so it will never be overwritten automatically. But then I was thinking, I think when you get these ransomware attacks and they encrypt your files, I think the extension changes on the file. And in that case, I'm wondering if an automatic synchronization to the cloud would just add the encrypted copy, because the file name would be slightly different in terms of the extension, and not wipe out the original. So that just occurred to me now. I was just going to bring this topic up. I don't know what the answer is to that. I could be wasting my time doing this second transfer over to Dropbox, but it's curious. I wonder if anyone have any insight on that. Maybe you.
KD2OGB. So, okay, you got back. You switched your radio site. So we're talking with Lou right now. He brought up an interesting subject of you know, attacks where they encrypt your drive and ransomware you, and you have to pay to get the decode key. And I mentioned that my new NAS is capable. It has a slightly different file system. I think it's more related to Linux. It's called BTFRS, and it has version capability. So you can set the drive to keep old copies of every file. So if you had ransomware that took your files, encrypted them, and overwrote them, there would be a previous version of them that wouldn't be encrypted. But also, Lou is discussing how he likes to use two different clouds, one synchronized, one non-synchronized. I don't know how that would relate. I don't think all encryption ransomware is created completely equal, although there's probably mostly script kiddies out there who are getting this thing farmed out to them. So there's probably only a few ways of doing this lately.
Yeah, so anyway, that just occurred to me. So I don't know. I mean, I'll keep doing what I'm doing for now. But I thought that was interesting because... And if, again, I'm not in the practice of encrypting files myself, but I guess the same question exists with encryption software. File xyz.dat, let's say, and you want to encrypt it. Does it change it to xyz. You know, some other extension, say, I don't know, anything, ABC. And actually, you know, the file's renamed, or does it leave the original one encrypted, create the encrypted one, and then go and delete the one that's in the clear? So, whatever the behavior is in the encryption would dictate the answer to that. So, but as I say, I'll just continue to go on. And that's it. That's all I got. Just wanted to throw that in and... just another thing, I did go to NearFest, the HamFest up in New Hampshire, and we did have good weather, and the rain came after the event, which was great, although driving back from New Hampshire was interesting. And I stopped at HRO, Ham Radio Outlet, and I picked up an SDR Play, SDR, which does HF and UHF, VHF, so I'm playing with that now. And I picked up a little desktop microphone for my ICOM, so that I don't have to hold the mobile microphone in my hand. And there you go. It's a wrap. NY2H back to net.
AC2GS. Well, I'm glad you got a new toy. SDR Play have a good reputation. We have some other people who are regulars on the technical net who have SDR Plays, and I heard nothing bad about them. I have a couple of SDRs. My favorite, of course, is my Plex, but I even have that little dongle, the RTL dongle that I play around with Raspberry Pis and do all kinds of interesting thing. You know, encryption is another wonderful topic that I've looked into for many years. I remember playing around with pretty good PGP. I forget what the pretty good password. I forget, but it's a pretty good privacy. That's what PGP stood for. It's had a kind of dicey career, unfortunately. I've also played around with TrueCrypt that just kind of blew up and disappeared in an hour and a half, and now I have VeraCrypt. You can put any extension you want or no extension on those containers, depending upon the degree of paranoia you might have. And, you know, things like TrueCrypt even allow you to have false vaults where it has two passwords. One password gives you nonsense or garbage or, you know, comic books or something, and the other one is the deed to all your properties and the password to all your crypto wallets.
Yeah, very good. It's great when they have these various options and features, and I guess that you call that a honeypot, where they try to lure you in purposely to misdirect you. And if you really wanted to be sinister, you could throw it back on them and do something nasty. But anyway, all interesting stuff. Yeah, pretty good privacy. And I think there's another version called GPG. They actually changed the letters around, but I'm not certain of that. There might be another variant.
I think that was just the new license for some version of PGP. PGP kind of had a schizophrenic life. They tried to kind of make it into a company, a profitable organization, and a lot of different places use the algorithms, you know, RSA, encryption algorithms. I think it's still respected to this day, but it's very confusing of what's available and what's, you know, a business license that's kind of overpriced. It's not really, at least from my experiences, designed anymore for the average guy who just likes to play around with encryption.
That's the whole thing, you know, and of course it's a moving target, right? I guess maybe not in the near future, but in the future, quantum coming up around, quantum computing and AI and all that stuff. So who knows? Who knows where it's going to go? All right. Why don't you pick up Craig again, and I will bow out and listen. And Y2H.
Okay, very good, Lou. Yeah, it's always a cat and mouse. No one just kind of sits there and says, okay, we're done. You build up an encryption algorithm, someone breaks it, you build a harder one to break, they break it, you build another one. The Enigma encryption was a very sophisticated one, was mechanical in design, and one of the key reasons why the British were able to break Enigma was because all of these fascists had to start their messages with Heil Hitler. So it was like handing everyone a decryption key.
Yeah, there's a flavor of karma to that. Beautiful.
Yes, indeed. It is a good story. It's a true story. It's fascinating to read these books and to see these documentaries on all that took place on Enigma and the brilliance of mathematicians who kind of twisted their brains into knots to decode and decrypt. Because it wasn't just stealing an Enigma machine. There were rotated keys for it every day. So it was a pain in the backside. It was one of the best-kept secrets, along with the Manhattan Project, that the Allies had. And there were times, unfortunately, where Britain had to suffer from plane assault, bombing, that so as not to give up the reality that they had broken the Enigma code. So there's a great deal of fascinating history and encryption technology and all kinds of things related to that. Anyway, thanks for bringing up that subject, Lou. I appreciate it. I always like to talk about encryption and those things. I find it fascinating, the idea that the present state of the art amounts to the products of two prime numbers and the difficulty of deconstructing the two initial prime numbers that hopefully, well, or not hopefully, the quantum computers will be able to do in a fraction of a second and turn all of our security layers into nonsense. But we'll come up with something else. There is elliptical constants and all kinds of fun stuff that people are playing with. Anyway, thanks a lot. So, Craig, you wanted to say something more about backing up?
Maybe a little bit. Again, I've looked into Wi-Fi hard drives, but I don't know if it's worth it. And plus, I don't know if you could even password protect those things since it's Wi-Fi based and technically any device can connect to it. And also, I do have Google Drive storage, and I actually have, since I have an Adobe license, I got 100 gigabytes of cloud storage, since I am paying for Premiere Pro and for the media encoder, and also I get Photoshop Express for free with it. But I'm not worried about ransomware attacks, since I have Malwarebytes on three machines, my computer, phone, and laptop, and I have the full version. What I actually had to do was, I actually had to cancel my subscription and then add in another one for three devices, even though it was due for renewal in 15 days, because when I went to add another device, it would be like almost full price, but then a month later, it would double charge me, and I didn't want that. So I ended up just canceling while I'm going to let it expire, but now I have a new license, and I reduced it down to three devices. Before I had it on two, now I have three.
Well, it's always good to have anti-malware and anti-viruses. I recommend them to everyone, and I use them myself. But you should never kind of assume that just because you're doing that, that it's going to catch everything. Because inevitably, if you look at the specs, different anti-malware, different anti-virus software is slightly better to pick up some things than other things. And you could never be 100% safe. It's still a good practice not to click on anything that strikes you as suspicious, which some people seem to do as a hobby, which I don't quite understand. But nevertheless, don't 100% rely on antiviral, anti-malware software. It's belt and suspenders, but occasionally you need a staple gun as well.
Benefit is, since I also have a McAfee account, and the license is actually less money, I can install it on as many devices as I want, so that's even a big plus. So, effectively, the license on how many devices, it's practically lifetime, and you can copy it over, I think.
As long as they update their virus list, if they just let you have the software for the rest of your life, but they don't upgrade the license, the virus list, then it's not a very good protection. And also to some people out there, don't think you're going to be clever by having five different antiviruses on your computer. It's probably going to slow things down to a crawl. If you kind of, you know, not all antivirus software is created equal. There are some that are very fast and light, and there are others that are just tortuous and slow everything down. And also, there's problems with some virus detection where you get a lot of false positives, which can be rather annoying. I mean, just take a text file and rename it TJet, and take a look what your antivirus does with it. It's kind of scary. They're hard-coded to say that anything called TGen is a dangerous piece of software.
Yeah, it can be weird in certain ways. So, like I said, I'm happy with what I have, so I'm not worried. I'm going to hop off for a little bit. I want to go see what's for dinner. I'll probably come back on in a little bit. So, take care. 82OGB. Back to Net Control.
Okay. Very good, Craig. Thank you for participating. Brian, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still with you guys.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure you hadn't stepped away. Your question was, what bands are interesting for HF? Well, it sort of depends on the individual, what they're looking for, and what they're capable of. There are some people who love the lower frequencies. not so much 160, although there are guys who love 160. But, you know, there are particularly guys who like 80 meters, or sometimes they call it 75 meters because it's the high end of the 80-meter band where a lot of the phone conversations take place. But in order to really take advantage of 75 meters, you usually need to have a bit of length because the efficient antennas tend to be rather long, and you either want to set it up vertically or in a slant. If you try and set it up horizontally, most people can't get the elevation necessary to get a decent takeoff angle and have it go off to the horizon where it could skip and get a far distance. On the other end of the spectrum is, for me, 10 meters. There are some people who love 6 meters, but I haven't found 6 meters to be that useful yet. 10 meters is much easier to get an antenna. You know, a half wavelength center fed is only 15-16 feet. It's only 5 meters in length, approximately. And especially during the sunspot maximum, the contacts that you could make are amazing. I have a 5/8 wave vertical on my roof, and a couple weeks ago I talked to Africa, Namibia. Usually I talk to England and Ireland or Washington State and places in between. Any particular HF fans presently have your interest? Brian? Brian, are you out there? This is AC2GS. Well, we seem to have lost contact with Brian, so hopefully he'll reestablish soon. But until then, I remain AC2GS right here with the Limar Technical Net. Anyone has any subjects, questions, comments, what have you, please hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
AD2DU.
Yes, Alex, what can I do for you tonight?
Does lighting affect the HF and UHF, VHF bands differently? I seem to today see lightning as like, a quick line across the IC7300 scope. Am I hearing it on VHF, UHF right now? Over.
Well, one important thing that you can't leave out is what type of frequency of modulation scheme you're using. If you're using amplitude modulation to one degree or another, you will hear something when lightning strikes. But you have to keep in mind that we here on the repeater are not using amplitude modulation or its cousin single sideband. We're using frequency modulation. So with frequency modulation, you know, as long as it doesn't knock out your electronics, a large burst of noisy RF is not going to impact the FM signal.
So would it affect AM rather than FM?
Yes, if you think about it, if you've ever listened to an AM broadcast during a thunderstorm, you've heard crackles coming in. But if you've ever listened to any FM broadcast, you've never heard crackles coming in.
Makes sense. You're out of my radio after this.
Yeah, you're getting a little bit noisy again, so whatever you did to make it sound better, try and do that some more. Also it's a matter of how high the frequencies are. The harmonic, you know, lightning strikes are a very harmonic rich signal. But as they go higher and higher and higher, the amount of energy tends to degrade, and the amount of loss, free space loss increases, and so they become less problematic. On the lower bands, on 80 meters or so, there's a lot of background lightning noise all over the damn place.
Got it. Well, thanks for the info, Roy. Well, you're welcome, Alex. Anytime, you know where to find us. We're here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Anyone else with any questions or comments for tonight or want to make a comment about what I made a comment about, please feel free. Hit that push to talk.
That's the one.
Yes, Paul. I'm sure you watched the launch, who have gone off rather well.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And it came out a little late, but, you know, I guess it was a half-hour difference from the original time. Anyway, they tried to take off a few days ago, but due to weather, that was they scrubbed that. Anyway, it's the Falcon Heavy launch with three boosters, three Falcons attached together, so it's like three in one. Put that over 5 million pounds of thrust, similar to about what the crew put out. They were putting a fire shot into orbit, geosynchronous orbit. And this thing is so heavy, it weighs like 6 tons, that they decided not to waste fuel on returning the boosters back to Cape Canaveral. So they just, the whole thing was an expendable system. And they used all the power to put this thing into a geosynchronous orbit. And it's a big satellite. I mean, they have tremendous solar panels on board. They're going to put out 25 kilowatts. You know, I have a 4 kilowatt generator. I could do the whole house here. Imagine 25, you know, 5-6 times the amount of power. It's one of those things. That's what it's putting out. Very successful. You know, going to do another burn, probably in about 20 minutes to circularize the orbit. But yeah, that's not what I wanted to say. I wanted to mention one other thing, Roy.
Sure.
It looks like Limelock YouTube. You know, we have a YouTube channel. They put on last week's presentation by this Bob Heil from Heil Microphones. You know, he's been around forever. And he did a presentation, and it was really very well done last Tuesday. I see the recording was successful, and they put the whole thing onto the Limelock. Go to the Limelock site, YouTube, and all the different presentations are there. And it was really quite well. I mean, it's well done. This guy really knew his stuff. It's all about the technical stuff behind it, plus his life history. Yeah, very interesting presentation. So, anybody that wants to see something like that, Limelock YouTube channel. Back to you.
Okay, that's very interesting. I have to catch that. I have sent and received emails from Bob Heil in past years. He ran a podcast called Damnation. I even had an offer to kind of go on it, and unfortunately I turned it down, or I might have been a star today. He's a very interesting gentleman. Of course, he owned a Heil Sound Incorporated for many, many years. They produced a lot of amateur radio microphones. I use a trigger switch that's a Heil trigger switch to this very day on this very show. He's a fascinating guy. His interests were in playing organ music, but he was a sound engineer for all kinds of famous rock stars. So I don't for the life of me know what those rock stars kind of thought of Bob. Bob was not really a rock star at heart, at least the last time I saw him. So he's a very interesting, very smart, clever guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He told all the rock star stories as well. He got that all in. So, yeah. You know, what the best frequencies, audio frequencies are to use, and which ones you should back on,
you know, how you set up your transmitter for the audio and on.
Very well done.
Back to you, Roy. I'll be listening.
Okay, very good. I used to be a regular watcher of Ham Nation. I kind of got out of the habit after a few years, but he was kind of one of the main reasons why I got into the hobby. When I was a kid, I told this story probably too many times. I could never find another ham, so I kind of tried to teach myself more so, but not terribly well. But in order to get a novice, you had to find a ham and arrange to be tested, and I could never kind of figure out how to do that. And so I got distracted by little things like going to college and learning the profession, and I put it off to the side. And then many years later, I was watching Twit is a technical podcast, and one of Twit's podcast involved Bob Hiles. They introduced him, and he mentioned that he was going to start something called Ham Nation, and they mentioned the fact that, and this was a regular computer-related type of podcast, so it wasn't really inherently an amateur radio podcast. He mentioned that Morse code was no longer a thing, and the guy running Twit was going to take the technician's test. He was planning to take the general test the following month and the extra the following month. And I said, well, if this guy can do it, maybe I can. And so I studied up a little bit and took my test, and here I am today. So possibly if Bob didn't get interviewed on Twit, I might to this day still not realize that the Morse code requirement had gone the way of all things. So that's my little story. Once again, I am AC2GS. If anyone has any comments or questions or topics for discussion, please feel free to hit that push-to-talk button.
Roy, one more thing.
Certainly, Paul.
Yeah, that was a boom for ham radio when they dropped the requirements. And at one point, they dropped it, I think, back down to 5 words a minute. But then they did away with it all entirely. And you had plenty of people joining amateur radio. They were great with computers and this and that. They didn't want anything to do with the Morse code. I was the opposite of you. I learned Morse code in the Boy Scouts. And I felt like I was actually pretty bad. I really enjoyed it. But as time went on, I looked at the requirements for getting a ticket. And I looked at the technical end. I said, "Forget it. I think this has to wait about another decade." And sure enough, I waited, and eventually I studied up on that. But the Morse code to me was the fun part. So, opposite, but the results were the same. We both have our licenses. Back to you.
Yes, indeed. Opposite. In high school, it wasn't a problem for me to buy the ARRL handbook, and I read it from cover to cover. So the technical stuff I was okay with. It was the Morse code. I've told the story again too many times probably, but I found some guy, a relative of a friend of the family who wasn't really interested in being an amateur radio operator, but he was curious about Morse code. And so he was kind of my partner in crime, and being high school kids, we basically just knocked out Morse code on gym lockers, and they tended to be obscenity. So that, unfortunately, to this day, if I just play around with a Morse code key without thinking about it, I get a flood of obscenities coming out of my muscle memory. So that's my memory of Morse code. What can I tell you?
Very, very good. Okay. Yeah. First words of foreign languages are usually the ones you're not supposed to use. I'll be listening, Roy.
Okay, very good, Paul. And I recall historically, because I wasn't around during that time, when Morse code ceased to be a requirement, some guys really fretted that this was the end of the hobby. That it was just going to be a bunch of appliance operators,
you know, they weren't going to know how to do anything, and that was the end of it. Morse code would be a thing of the past. If people weren't required to do it, they wouldn't do it, which demonstrated that people don't know other human beings. Because my understanding from guys who manufacture high-quality, expensive Morse code keys is that they've never sold as many as they have after CW ceased to be a requirement. There's the Long Island CW organization. There's a lot of people who are deeply interested in CW, and even though it's not a requirement, it still persists. I've tried to kind of teach myself. My problem is that I get distracted, and you need to really persevere day in and day out. You can't kind of do it in a month and then stop doing it and then go back to doing it. You have to consistently do it.
Okay, yeah, that's very true. And I could probably do away with microphone on my HF rig. Anytime I turn it on, I'm tuning around on the CW band. But back to you.
Okay, very good. AC2GS here with the Weimar Technical Net. Anyone out there with any questions or comments for tonight, or if Brian has come back into the room? If you're there, Brian, tell me if I talked enough about the HF bands, or if you have any specific questions about HF bands that I can answer tonight.
WB2BXO with a comment.
Yes, Brian.
Yeah, what I find interesting is telling a guy on the local club net who's amazed that I'm just short of DXCC on 80 meters, he's saying, you can work DX on 80 meters? I didn't think that was possible. But with a reasonably efficient antenna, and even sometimes with an inefficient antenna, it could work DX on just about any band, 160 through 6 meters. There were guys working into Brazil on 6 meters today. I didn't work any of them, but I have worked into Europe on 6 meters. Anyway, that's probably seems to be the toughest band to work real VX on. 160, of course, the challenge is having an antenna that's a football field long. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the big problem when it gets to the 80 meters or lower is you really cannot have a decent DX horizontal antenna. You can use a sloper or you can use a vertical, but if you demand to use a fully horizontal and you can only manage something like 10, 15 feet off the ground, you're going to have a near vertical incident skyway. You'll be able to talk to your neighbors very well. You just are not going to get anything that most people would consider DX. I think that's what trips a lot of people up because they just don't have the room to have the elevation or to have the takeoff angle of either a sloper or a vertical.
Yeah. Some people say I'm cheating, renting a station online with a dipole up 100 feet. But, it's kind of fun to see what can be done with 100 watts and a real antenna on that band. Not even a big amplifier. There are guys running huge amps on that band. But even with 100 watts to a decent antenna, it's kind of amazing what you can work on 160. But it is tough. Go ahead.
Hey, Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
The 80-meter DX window is always pretty good. You know, I just run a 100-watt dipole, and at night, there always seems to be somebody on there, you know, from Europe or somewhere. You know, the frequency is between 3.785 megahertz and 3.800. You know, that 15 spread right there. And sometimes, you know, a little before, a little after, you know how it goes. But that area is well known. is equal to your DX window. I don't know what 160 would be, but I don't use that, just 80. Back you are.
Oh, okay, that's good to know. How high is the elevation of your dipole?
My dipole, it's only maybe 30 feet, that's it. And in fact, I got to pull it back up. It's starting to slope more and more, you know. The rope is getting tied on one end. So every now and then, I'll pull it up again. But it's 30 feet maybe at the low end, maybe 35 or 30, a little higher on the other end because it goes up a hill. I have a hill in the back that's probably about 12 feet high. So that gives me a little advantage on one side of it. So it's somewhat of a sloper, but I mean, if you looked at it, you know, you couldn't tell it's sloping. It's so long.
Oh, okay. Well, that's pretty good getting out that well with that little elevation. My fan dipole was about 35-odd feet at the top, and then it was a V, inverted V, and it was okay. It's nothing special, and, because it was shortened and loaded on either side, it had a rather high Q, and I really had to use an antenna tuner to get it to tune beyond its sweet spot.
Yeah, okay. You know, I don't have houses or buildings on top of me, so that helps too. Maybe if I was in more of a crowded area, it might be a problem. But it's okay. That works fine. And then I have a G5RV, a junior. It's not as long as the original. I use that for the other bands, you know, right now mostly 40 meters. And that works out okay for that as well. But actually, that's on a completely different trees. That one's actually a little higher, probably, you know, a good 35 feet from one end to the other. Anyway, I don't want to. I know you were talking to Frank, but I just wanted to give you the DX window. Back to you.
Well, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. So Frank, so you're remoting into that radio that you're doing the DXCC on?
Yeah, as we talked about before, yes. You can do that. The only requirement is that the DXCC is that all the contacts be made from the same country. You know, I did look that up. That is legitimate, so, you know, a lot of people don't like it. But, you know, hey, what's the difference between that and the guys who, you know, spend tens of thousands of dollars to put up this stacked arrays or Delta loops on 80 meters and stuff like that. To me, that sounds more like cheating than using 100 watts to a dipole on a remote. Go ahead.
Yeah. We live in a world where some forms of enhancement are frowned upon. You know, I guess the ultimate challenge is to making certificates based on only utilizing a 100-watt light bulb as the radiator, and the mast is a 5-foot wooden fence post. That would kind of level the ground, I guess, for everyone. And the only difference would then have to be technique.
Well, that's what the World Radio Sports Championship tries to do. They try to have everybody using an identical station in nearby locations. Were supposedly, and I don't know that much about it, but if Alan is on, he probably knows a lot more about it. But anyway, what they try to do is level out every other factor except operator skill and see who's the best. So things like that have been tried. And I think there are guys who have tested their FT8 stations on the dummy load and shown up on PSK Reporter as being heard in a couple of places. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's the beauty of FT8. It's theoretically, I think when it was first released, it was kind of meant as a you know, below noise, low power alternative. You didn't have to have massive antennas. You didn't have to have linear amplifiers. And because of its improved, decreased symbol rate, error correction, forward error correction algorithms, you could actually pick it up below the local noise floor, which still amazes me. But people kind of turned around and said, well, that's nice, but I want to